Hello, I'm Mercedes Stevenson, and you're listening to The West Block. The cost of living is on the minds of millions of Canadians, and one of the most painful and unavoidable costs is shopping at the grocery store. Earlier this year, the federal government announced it was committing $5 million a year to help investigate rising grocery prices. Months before that, the industry minister told the West Bloc,
I'm starting to make calls to some CEOs around the world and say, hey, have you looked at Canada lately? It's part of the number of things that I'm trying to do. Like I said, on day four, we're far from saying it's done. We're saying this is a fight.
Where is he in that battle more than 7 months later? We caught up with the minister as he announced an historic car deal for this country. Honda will invest $15 billion to create four new electric vehicle plants in Ontario.
This is more than just about the auto sector. This is about Canada punching above its weight.
François-Philippe Champagne, Minister of Innovation, Science and Industry, joined me after his announcement in Alliston, Ontario. Thank you so much for making time. I know you've got a busy morning there, Minister, and a big announcement for the government with this huge investment from Honda. Electric batteries, everyone is hoping, of course, that we can move forward and do things that are better for the environment. But one of the questions is whether Canada is ready for this number of electric vehicles and electric batteries, the grid system that supports that, the number of chargers, rural areas. Still not the level of investment that really makes this attainable for a lot of Canadians. Is your government planning to put more into that so that these vehicles you're building and these batteries you're building can be absorbed into the market?
Well, sure. And let's celebrate as Canadians today. I mean, you've seen today the largest single investment in the auto industry in the nation history. The largest investment of Honda in 75 years history. I mean, listen, it's sending a signal to the world that we have the best worker in the world, that the place to invest is in Canada, because now we have the full supply chain when it comes to battery electric vehicle. Honestly, today is really a game changer. We're talking about 240,000 electric vehicles that are going to come from the plants that we're talking about. We're talking in four plants in reality in this announcement today. So this is really a day for Canadians to celebrate. We're really punching above our weight. The world is noticing, and Canada is becoming really this hub for green manufacturing.
I think there's no question. It's a big win to have this kind of investment in Canada from a very reputable company. But I don't think it answers the question of whether or not your government is doing enough to electrify Canada so that people will realistically be able to drive these vehicles.
Well, we're going to do more. And this is great, because when you have an investment like that, it's kind of a catalyst. I think everyone knows that the final destination is electric vehicle. Now you're seeing Honda tripling down. It's not even doubling down. I remember talking to the chairman of Honda in Tokyo some 2 years ago, and I made the pitch for Canada, and he said, I heard you, just be patient. And that this was patience well invested, because now they recognize that with the, you know, the plant in Alliston is one of the best performing, if not the best performing, that they have in the world. So it starts with people, and then obviously the fact we have critical minerals, renewable energy, access to market, makes Canada a place of choice to manufacture the cars of the future.
Well, let's talk about another big part of your portfolio. Last time you were on the show, we talked about the fact that you actually do your own grocery shopping. So you are certainly
Indeed.
Seeing the prices in the stores. You were optimistic at that point that you thought Canadian grocers were going to act. You had sort of the carrot of asking them and the stick of the threat of a windfall tax. You didn't implement that windfall tax in the budget. Why not?
I'm on their back all the time. You know, we ask something, what we get was not what we wanted, and then we change the law, and we change the rules of competition. And I think that is the best way in order to make sure that not only now, but for the foreseeable future, we'll have more competition in the country. And folks at home understand that the best way to put pressure on prices is to have more competition. In addition to that, yes, I've been in touch with foreign grocers to see whether we can entice some of them to come in the Canadian market, because if you look at what's happening in Australia and New Zealand, in markets in Europe, we have too much concentration when it comes to grocery in the country. And certainly the rules that we made, the change that we made on competition, the biggest reform since the Act has been enacted, you know, decades ago, that is already more conducive to bring foreign entrants. I'll give you an example. Before, you know, when you had one grocer in one particular area, they can force out basically to leases the people that would come around. When you talk to the independent grocers of Canada, they'd say, that's why when you see a big banner, you don't see any smaller grocers, because they had these rules within the lease that prevent anyone coming around. Well, we made that illegal now. So those are the type of things which will have a direct impact. I appreciate it's not like a switch you can turn on and off. I'm on their back, we'll continue, but I would say the reform of competition is a step in the right direction to bring stability in the prices we see in Canada.
If the most important thing is competition, then you're likely going to have to bring in the foreign grocers who you mentioned. What would make them want to come to Canada? Because if I were a foreign chain looking, I might look at the history of what happened with Nordstrom, what happened with Target in coming to Canada, very successful, very large American companies that wrapped up their operations here and left. So how would you reassure foreign grocers that if they come into such a concentrated market with high building costs, high construction costs, and established players, that they have a chance of being successful?
Well, the change in competition, I'll tell you, I met one of them in the United States, and the biggest hurdle they had was about leases. They could not find 400 or 500 leases or property to lease in Site A in the country, despite them being very big, billions of dollars. And they said, Minister, now that you change that, it's changing the game. Now we're going to look at Canada again. So is it easy? No. Is it worth trying? Definitely. You know, when I started with these battery plants, people were laughing. Say, Minister, we never had one, and now we have, a number of them and counting. So, listen, it always started with a phone call. We went there. I keep engaging with them, and I'm hopeful. It's not going to be easy, but it's worth trying because Canadians, we know that, you know, housing, the cost of living, those are top of mind to people, and obviously grocery is top of mind. So I'll do everything I can to be their voice, to be on the back of CEOs, and to make sure that we have more competition in the country.
Are you close to closing a deal with any of those foreign grocers?
Listen, it's never easy. It takes time because, to your point, you need to engage. We need to expand the change in dynamics. I say Canadians are ready for someone new in the market, deep discounters, people which would offer quality and competitive prices. So you know me, I'd rather work and then announce than the other way around. So let me do the work. And when we have hopefully good news, then we can share with Canadians.
Minister, I wanted to ask you about your government's interaction with China. Obviously, it's been a pretty frosty relationship over recent years. We learned that the Deputy Minister of Foreign Affairs traveled to China to try to reopen some of those ties. You're the industry minister where I know there's tremendous concern about the possibility of Chinese interference, stealing trade secrets, trying to lure some of our top scientists or top inventors to China. Is your government, from your department, also looking to reopen those ties with China or to have a closer relationship?
Well, you know, you're talking to a former foreign affairs minister. So my way when it looks to China is always to engage with eyes wide open. That's what we've done. We've made sure to different policy when it comes to research security, when it comes to critical minerals, when it comes to strategic supply chain, to make sure that we would protect our national security and our economic security. That's what Canadians expect from us. At the same time, you know, we realize that China is a large economy, and therefore some level of engagement like we're seeing now with the Deputy Minister of Foreign Affairs going in China, I think it is the right thing. You know, you need to engage, but at the same time, we need to be eyes wide open. And I've always been working with industry, with partners to make sure we do that. We have strengthened our rules to protect our national security, protect our intellectual property, making sure that we have better defense on cybersecurity, that we have rules around artificial intelligence and, you know, what's critical for our economy. So that's really the framework, you know, engage but with eyes wide open.
Minister, thank you so much for joining us today, and we appreciate your time.
It's always a pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
While Ukraine is in the fight of its life against Russia, the president of neighboring Belarus is cozying up to Vladimir Putin. Belarusian dictator Alexander Lukashenko snatched control of the country, announcing himself the victor after what much of the West called a fraudulent election in 2020. He's expected to run again next year in a so-called election, which would extend his rule to 36 years. And earlier this year, he signed a law stating that exiled opposition leaders cannot run in future elections. That would include Svetlana Tikhanovskaya. The former English teacher ran against Lukashenko in 2020 and was subsequently threatened with 15 years in a prison camp. She now lives in exile with her young children, heading a government in waiting to help bring Belarus back to democracy. I sat down with her in a feature interview. Svetlana, thank you so much for taking the time to sit down with us today and tell us a bit about yourself and about the very serious situation in Belarus, which is such an important country in Europe and in the conflict with Ukraine that Canadians don't hear about very often. You are the leader of the opposition in Belarus, but you can't live there. In fact, if you went home, you would likely be jailed and you could be killed. Can you tell us, what is that like for you?
For too long, Belarus has been perceived as part of Russia, appendix of Russia, satellite of Russia, but we are not. The European nation who wants to return to its European roots, who wants to be part of this European family of countries, but there is a dictator who is dragging us back into the Soviet Union past. I was sentenced to 15 years in absentia already. I'm extremist and I'm terrorist in my country, but actually we have thousands of declared extremists and terrorists among Belarusian people. It's best doctors, best teachers, it's elderly people. Everybody who is opposing the regime automatically becomes extremist in Belarus. We have plenty of extremists in Belarusian jails. These are our political prisoners. So extremists in Belarus is people who fighting for democratic values.
That includes Svetlana's husband, who was grabbed from the street after announcing he was going to run against the current president. He was sentenced to more than 19 years in prison. Protests over his detainment, efforts by Amnesty International, and appeals by world leaders have all gotten nowhere.
I can't imagine what that must be like for you. Do you know how he's doing? Have you been able to speak to him or get any kind of an update? So my husband is in jail for almost 4 years. Already, and since he was imprisoned, I haven't had possibility to talk to him at all. But a new way of torturing political prisoners is to keeping people in incommunicado mode. It's a new word that we have to learn. It means that lawyer is not allowed to visit our beloved, letters are not delivered, so people are kept in full isolation. It's a way to persuade our political prisoners that they're forgotten. And I haven't heard anything from my husband for 1 year, nothing. I don't know if he's alive. My children asking me every day, where is our daddy? Why we don't receive letters from him? They know that he's in prison. They know that he's hero of Belarus. But why, what's happened? Is he dead? They're asking me, and it's the most painful, you know, not this uncertainty.
The man her husband tried to challenge, the current president of Belarus, Alexander Lukashenko. He's been called Europe's last dictator. And he's cozied up to Russian President Vladimir Putin.
We saw what happened to one of the greatest critics of the Russian regime, Navalny, being killed. How concerned are you for your husband in that scenario that Lukashenko could adopt these same tactics as Putin?
Of course, when I knew about this tragedy, about murder of Alexei Navalny, I thought that murder of Navalny could be or green light or red line for dictators. It will depend on the response of the democratic world. If response will not be decisive and strong enough, it will give opportunity for all the dictators to kill their opponents in prison without any consequences. Of course, you think about my husband, and of course it's painful. But also, you know, I had the opportunity to meet with Yulia Navalny, wife of Alexei. She's a rather strong, like, person. Many women underestimate their strength, but when life puts you in the situation when you have to show all your power, your internal strength, you just stand and do what you have to do.
How would you describe the relationship between Vladimir Putin and Alexander Lukashenko?
It's symbiotic friendship. It's friendship when they need each other, they use each other. For many years, Lukashenko played a role of seesaw between West and Russia. When they winter, he made friendship with Putin because he needed cheap gas and oil. In summer, he made friendship with Euro because he needed extra money. When in 2020, you know, Putin supported him economically, politically, and now he's like loyal to Putin, fully loyal. So for Putin, Lukashenko is also necessary because Lukashenko is very cheap, very loyal. Partner for him. Lukashenko will provide our territory, our infrastructure for any Russian troops if they will try and, you know, invade Ukraine from our side, or there are like talks that they might attack European countries. So they just need each other, using each other to circumvent sanctions at the moment. But it's not about good relationship. It's about surviving at the moment.
There have been reports of Russian nuclear weapons placed in Belarus. Can you speak to what you know about that and what kind of signal that sends?
We know that some facilities are being prepared for this nuclear weapon. Nuclear weapon is attempt to terrorize Belarusians, to blackmail Western countries, but the main aim of this deployment is to anchor the presence of Russia in our country for many years ahead, because it will be very difficult to get rid of this nuclear weapon in the future. And also in case, you know, these brutal dictators will decide to use kind of nuclear weapon, a counterattack will be on Belarus, because Putin will launch this nuclear weapon from our country.
Countries such as Canada have announced sanctions against Belarus, the latest when Svetlana met with Prime Minister Justin Trudeau earlier this month. The sanctions were levied against 21 people on human rights violations.
What do you think of the West and NATO's response, which has largely been to continue to funnel money and military aid to Ukraine, as well as to sanction individuals in Belarus and in Russia? Is it effective? Is it enough?
I really consider sanctions to be the most effective instrument for weakening the regimes, but the sanctions don't work effectively because of the huge loopholes that the sanctions have. Sanctions on Russia are imposed mostly on import and Belarus on export. They're using each other to circumvent sanctions. Lukashenko buys goods for Russia. Russia sells Belarusian goods that are under sanctions in Belarus. So it's like, new schemes that everybody knows. And we ask and we demand synchronization of sanctions between Russia and Belarusian regime for them to work effectively.
What's your view on what will happen if Russia wins in Ukraine?
Ukrainians, as nation, they will fight the last soldier, the last person. And of course, if the democratic world will stop assisting Ukraine, and if we allow Russia to prevail in this war, it will not be defeat of Ukraine. It will be defeat of the democratic world. And because Ukrainians are not fighting for their land, they're fighting for the very values that your countries, democratic countries, are enjoying. And believe me, we know dictatorship better. If to allow the beast, you know, to prevail in one country, they will not stop there. They will challenge the democratic world further. And believe me, the next doors this enemy will knock, it will be your doors.
Thank you so much for sitting down with me and explaining this issue to us. And our thoughts are with you and your children, and certainly with your husband too, as you all fight for freedom in Belarus.
Thank you.
And now for one last thing. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and his cabinet have been crisscrossing the country promoting their federal budget. But the budget blitz may be in vain, at least according to the polls. In an exclusive poll for Global News, Ipsos found just a few days after the budget that 34% of Canadians surveyed said the budget made it less likely they would vote for the Liberals. Only 8% say they'd be more likely to vote for the Liberals. And for most people, 58%, it didn't change their views. Pierre Poilievre continues to enjoy a significant lead over Justin Trudeau, with the Tories leading the Liberals 43% to 24%. However, being the front runner comes with greater scrutiny and expectations, which means his unplanned stop at a convoy-like encampment last week of people who say they were protesting the carbon tax created a problem for the Conservative leader.
Everyone's happy with what you're doing.
Videos from people at the encampment documented Poilievre's visit and show him standing next to F. Trudeau flags. And this flag, doodled on a trailer door, is of much greater significance. That's the symbol of a far-right extremist group called Diaghilon that CSIS has warned about. The Liberals pounced immediately.
Diaghilon is a violent white nationalist organization. Anyone who wants to be prime minister of this country needs to be clear with Canadians about whose votes he wants and who he stands with.
Poilievre's office says he was just stopping to see an anti-carbon tax protest. Diaghilon isn't a fan of Pierre Poilievre. They mock him and they've threatened his wife. But his office didn't condemn the group when asked about the pit stop. Canadian voters have a dilemma between broken Liberal promises, scandals, and too little too late, and the Conservatives' controversies and tone challenges. Both major parties have questions about political leadership. That's our show for today. Thank you for joining us. We'll be back here next Sunday. I'm Mercedes Stevenson for the West Block.
Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.